It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, the Great Lakes water levels are down. Our guest will help us sort out the mystery of why the levels are changing.
First, though, tonight marks Governor Scott Walker's final State of the State address during his first term as governor.
With nearly a $1 billion budget surplus recently announced, it's likely he'll spend time laying out what to do with that money. But it's an election year and an important speech for him, so what else can we expect? Here to give us a preview is WPR's state government reporter, Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, what is Governor Walker's most important task in this State of the State address tonight?
I think he laid it out pretty well. I mean, it's an election year. If he was going to have a surplus to be talking about in any State of the State address, this is probably the one that he'd pick. He has, the task of laying out what he's going to do with that money. And we already know that he's going to be talking about tax cuts, specifically some mix of income and property tax cuts with an emphasis on the property tax cuts.
Well, let's pursue that angle for a little bit, and later I'd like to get back into the election some. Where did that surplus come from? Why do we suddenly have this surplus?
Most of it came from, we don't have it yet. It is a projected surplus, which is, the way the state does its business. It projects how much money it's going to take in through the income tax, the sales tax, the corporate income tax. And, in this instance, all of those are projected to go up. And so you throw in some other factors with some funds that are projected to lapse, and the state now has $912 million more. It's projected to have $912 million more to work with over this biennium. And, this is – how do they get those numbers? A lot of factors. They go through a national firm that looks at this stuff for other states, Global Insight. Global Insight looks at stuff, everything from what the Fed is doing with monetary policy to what people are purchasing. The State Legislative Fiscal Bureau looks at how tax collections are coming in so far in Wisconsin, and this is their best answer right now as to what they expect we're going to take in through, the end of June next year.
With these State of the State addresses, sometimes it seems like everything is leaked before the actual event. Sometimes it's a little more hush-hush. Seems like all that's out there is the talk of the kind of tax cuts and tax relief that the governor is going to present tonight. What do we know about what he's going to propose so far?
We know that he wants to prioritize the property tax cut. And so as you look at where he's going to be proposing money spent or, tax cuts, about $400 million of what he's going to propose is going to be aimed at a property tax cut. It's going to be funneled through the technical colleges, so it's something that, should be fairly evenly distributed throughout the state. And then another $100 million about would be focused on an income tax cut. And this is a little different than the income tax cut that he did in the most recent budget. This income tax cut would be just for the lowest income bracket. So everybody would get a piece of it that pays income taxes, but it would be focused on that lowest bracket. And you can imagine that's an election year strategy for him because it makes it harder for Democrats to say that he's focusing these tax cuts on the rich.
With that technical college tax cut, the way that would work, correct me if I'm wrong, technical colleges would get more direct support from the state that would offset a decrease in the amount of property tax they collect from their local levies. Is that right?
Yeah, they call it in the parlance of state government buying down the levy. And so the state will be sending more money to technical colleges, but it's not money that the technical colleges will then get to turn around and spend on increased programming. It will, essentially eat up the share of funding that would be going to the technical colleges through the property tax.
And then the third wheel of this tax cut tricycle, bad metaphor, forget I said that, is not actually a tax cut, but a change in the way withholding works, right? So money that we would get usually in a rebate is just not deducted in the first place. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and again, this is something that the property tax cut actually wouldn't be noticed until after the election. And so, if you're looking at it strictly from a political standpoint, maybe that's not the best way to get people's attentions. So the withholding changes that you mentioned there are you know, just as you described it, instead of waiting until, you know, April to get a refund from state government, you get money that they're over withholding in each paycheck. And so the state hasn't adjusted these withholding tables for a while, partly because cash flow has been an issue. Now that the state has some cash flow, they have the opportunity to do this. It's not technically a tax cut, but it's not something that the state can do if it doesn't have revenue to work with.
You mentioned the election implications of these changes in the taxes, but this is all in line with the Republican worldview. Cut taxes. The state is getting more money. It should go back to the citizens. That, the theory goes, will help the economy. Is that the way it's being presented, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is in line with what they talk about. Where it sort of falls short of the Republican worldview, at least for some Republicans, is that what the governor is proposing would apparently increase the state's structural deficit by about $100 million. And we don't have the memo from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau on the hard numbers on what that's going to, you know, what that's going to be. But, you know, it would grow the state's structural deficit from what the governor told reporters. And essentially, the structural deficit is a measure of how much cash the state has on hand at the start of a budget cycle compared to how much it's already committed to spending. So when the state starts its next two-year budget, you know, by the best numbers that we have right now, before the governor does anything, the state already faces a $708 million structural deficit between what it has and what it has to pay for.
And then some Republicans, as you were suggesting there, are not entirely on board, especially in the Senate, right?
Yeah, especially in the Senate. And you've got some senators there that have been around for a while. They've seen the state go through the booms and the busts, and you know, they've seen what happens when there's windfalls of revenue, and you know, what happens a few years later when those go away. And so they're pushing to really take care of the structural deficit. They want to make sure that money gets put away and that the state doesn't get too carried away with tax cuts, and they view that as fiscal conservatism. And actually, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said today that, you know, if the governor's plan is going to grow that, there are going to be some of his members who have a problem with that. You know, much different story in the state assembly, where Republican leaders there don't have that problem, and they say that the reason is they think economic growth will erase any structural deficit, and it's not anything you have to worry about.
What's been the response from Democrats?
Democrats, I think now that the structural deficit number is kind of out there, you're seeing Democrats really highlight that, because this is something that Republicans talked about when Jim Doyle was governor. Something candidate Walker talked about before he was governor. Were the structural deficits run up under Governor Jim Doyle. You know, so Democrats are seizing on that, and I think they're also going to be talking about what they see as Governor Walker's weakness in this election year, and that is how Wisconsin compares to its Midwest neighbors and the nation in terms of job growth. You know, the state is adding jobs, the economy, you know, you can't have an uptick in income and sales tax without having an economy that is growing in some way. Okay, but the thing that Democrats are going to highlight is that Wisconsin is lagging its neighbors. You know, it's fallen behind the competition in terms of where it could be with growth, and especially job growth, where the governor, you know, famously promised he was going to help Wisconsin create 250,000 jobs in his first term. That's a number he's mentioned in two out of his three State of the State speeches. You know, we'll see if he mentions it tonight, but you can be sure the Democrats will.
There have been calls for various things to do with the money, the projected surplus, including education and job training. Do you anticipate any talk of job training or other job promotion programs in the State of the State tonight?
Yeah, I don't know if the governor's going to talk about using surplus on job training. And it might seem like, you know, an insignificant nuance, but he's probably going to talk about using money that's set aside in an account controlled by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Actually, it's under the control of the state legislature right now, but I think you might see him call for some type of job training program using this $35 million surplus that's in another account. That's a possibility. He has sent no signs that he's going to be using this money to, you know, increase funding for education or to, you know, cuts that education took, school funding took in the last budget under Governor Doyle and Governor Walker's first budget. That just hasn't been in the conversation among Republicans. We'll see how much Democrats push it. They've been talking about a balanced approach between tax cuts and education, but I don't know how much they're gonna push that tonight.
We're talking to WPR State Government Reporter Sean Johnson about the governor's State of the State address coming up at 7 o'clock tonight.
We're back with WPR's Capitol reporter Sean Johnson, and he's giving us a preview of this evening's State of the State address.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you want to hear Governor Walker address in his speech? Do you think the tax cut should be the top item on his agenda? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take a call now. We've got Kevin with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Actually, one quick comment, and then my question is, I'm actually a teacher. I would love to hear him put some more back into public education, but my real question is this. This is all sounding like talk of projected budget and projected income, and the revenues should be there. I guess I just don't understand large-scale, stateside, national economics. I'd really love to hear some more about that.
So do we, how sure are we, and more importantly, are the lawmakers, that the money's really going to be there, Sean?
I mean, it's based on the best available information they have in front of them. I mean, you could go through the Legislative Fiscal Bureau's memo on information they received from Global Insight on a variety of factors that Global Insight uses to come up with revenue estimates, not just for Wisconsin, but for other states, and how Fiscal Bureau then kind of combined that with what it knew about Wisconsin to reach, you know, the number here. You could probably read that that memo and come away more confused in a way. It's fairly complicated stuff. I would just say it's the best info we have right now. And yeah, things change, obviously. I mean, this is already a revised estimate from last year. So they do this from time to time, and yet there are other times when Fiscal Bureau's estimates using these numbers, using this data, are, you know, scary on the mark, and you wonder how they did it. But I would just say that it's not based on nothing. It's not based on just hopes or looks like things are going well.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the same really data set that other states use when they're coming up with their estimates.
Moving on to other issues, the State of the State potentially and sometimes has been a bully pulpit to say to the state legislature, let's get the job done on issue X. Do you think that there are any issues currently languishing in the legislature that he might make a push for?
Yeah, I don't know. That's something where he hasn't been out talking as much about his plans. He has, his State of the State addresses have not been sort of as chock full of new ideas or new policies as previous governors, whether it be Governor Doyle or Governor Thompson, where they'd really use these speeches as an opportunity to go through, you know, here are some new ideas I have, here are some things I want to shepherd through. Governor Walker does that, but not to the same degree. I think one thing that's worth watching tonight is whether he talks about some type of school accountability bill. This is something that he highlighted, I think it was a couple years ago now, that he wanted to have a school accountability law that would hold public schools, private schools, voucher schools, hold all schools accountable for the dollars that they receive from the state. And that's an idea that's really just kind of languished in the legislature. There is a proposal out there this year from Republican lawmakers. Again, it's kind of languishing. So it'll be interesting to see if the governor throws some weight behind that or if that's something he just leaves to the legislature.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Sandra with us in Racine. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I would like to see more money put into public education, too, since some was taken out. I also would like him to focus on jobs, because trickle-down hasn't worked, and I don't think the hundred-some dollars in return, and I don't know based on what value of your home or whatever, I don't really think that that's going to spur on the economy as well as focusing on jobs so we get more people working.
Thanks for the call, Sandra. Sean, is that something that we've heard from Democrats critical of the governor's approach?
In terms of the size of the tax cut, they did that with a tax cut that Republicans enacted last year. I mean, they kind of pointed out that this is not huge, that for the average person, you're not going to see a lot of extra money in your pocket. I don't know yet if that's something that they're going to talk about with this plan. They might want to wait till they see more details. But yeah, I mean, that's the debate in Wisconsin, as it is in the national level, is, you know, is this really going to work, or is this just going to be something that sets us up for bad budget situations in the future? And as far as money for public education, you can imagine if this was a Jim Doyle State of the State address and you had a $1 billion surplus, there probably would be talk of that, especially if Democrats were running the legislature. But I think it's just illustrative of, you know, the different times that we're in right now and the approach of a Republican governor and Republican legislature who have, you know, consistently prioritized tax cuts over increased spending.
A lot of times a big part of the State of the State address isn't just legislation for the future, but looking at past successes. What kind of things do you think the governor might highlight?
I think he'll talk about his last budget a little bit. You might hear him talk about voucher schools. He's been a big advocate of them, and he's done a lot to expand them. I know that in the tidbits that he announced already, he's going to be talking about health care, specifically his health care plan, which, you know, differs greatly from what most states are doing. He's going to highlight the fact that for the first time, everyone who has an income, whether they're parents or they're childless adults, if they have an income below the poverty level, they'll be able to get Badger Care in Wisconsin. I don't know that he's going to talk about the flip side of that equation and talk about the people, the parents, who were on Badger Care but are going to be pushed off in April under the changes, you know, ushered through by Republicans. And also, you know, he's going to talk about the tuition freeze. Hmm. That was a big topic at the Capitol last year. That's something else that you can imagine him talking about on the campaign trail in 2014. It's not something he initially proposed, but kind of at the urging of the legislature, that's how that ultimately happened.
I'd like to spend the last couple of minutes looking ahead at the election this fall. We in the media probably look at this kind of thing as maybe an opening salvo in that election campaign. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this kind of sets the table for what he's going to be talking about. I think the tone that he comes out with tonight is going to be very similar to what you're going to hear the rest of the year. I think the way that he addresses the jobs issue, you know, whether he says, like, I'm still pushing for that 250,000 jobs, or if he kind of sidesteps around it, might give you an inkling toward how he's going to approach it the rest of the year. And this is what he's going to talk about tonight is what he's going to want to talk about on the campaign trail, not necessarily stuff that he did in the first, second, or third year of his governorship.
That's the state campaign trail. Then there's the national audience. Do you think, there's always the talk that he might run for president. Is there a sense that, hey, the whole nation is watching to see how he carries himself and what kind of message he sends?
I think conservative news outlets are watching it. National conservative writers are watching it. Conservative primary voters, maybe a little bit, though it seems, you know, like maybe he hasn't gotten their attention at this point. Yeah, he's on sort of the short list of a lot of national pundits of who could be the nominee next time. But if you look at polls, you know, in Iowa or even in Wisconsin, he's not running away with it. So while it's sort of generally assumed among people who watch Wisconsin politics that this is something that he's interested in, it's not like it's just going to be handed to him. And he does have, in Wisconsin, a state that's very closely divided. He has a serious Democratic challenger in Mary Burke in the race for governor, And, you know, Scott Walker's approval rating has never really gone north of 51% here in Wisconsin. So just by the very nature of Wisconsin, by the nature of the candidate he is, you get a sense that this November could be another close race.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. That's WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson. He won't leave it there because he's going to be covering the State of the State address. It'll broadcast live here on the Ideas Network at 7 tonight. He'll co-host with Frederica Freiberg from Wisconsin Public Television. You can stream the event at WPR.org at 7 tonight. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll get our weekly look into what Congress is up to with Paul Singer of USA Today.
First, new reports out this week could shed some light on why the Great Lakes are experiencing very low water levels.
According to our next guest, the lakes, along with other bodies of water, experience natural 10-year cycles of ebbing and flowing. But recent evidence suggests that the cycle might be broken. But why?
Joining us now is Carl Watrous, research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us, please, about this 10-year cycle and the research you've been doing looking at that.
Well, technically, it's about a 13-year cycle, but let's not quibble. We began thinking about this in about 2005, 2006, when our local lake levels up here in Vilas County were dropping precipitously. And so we stumbled on a data set that extended back 70 years for these small lakes, and they showed this oscillation. And then we compared that oscillation in our little lakes to Lake Michigan Huron, and they were virtually the same. And then we got a little bolder and decided to look at our groundwater tables as well, and they were fluctuating the same way. So we put together several pieces of a puzzle and were able to detect a signal that's pretty much region-wide.
Why are those all, the groundwater, the small lakes, the Great Lakes, in sync with each other on that cycle?
Well, that's a good question. We think it's because there is a major driver that's affecting everything the same. So even though the lakes and the groundwaters and these huge lakes have different hydrologic budgets, there's one factor that overrides all those detailed differences. And that factor, it turns out, is the difference between precipitation and evaporation. That's called the net atmospheric flux of water. So as that varies in time, we see our lakes rise and fall, and that variability seems to be oscillating at a frequency of about 13 years, at least up till roughly 1990-1998.
Right, and that's where I want to pick up, that it seems like we're starting, if I'm reading it right, to break that 13-year cycle.
Right. The Lake Michigan Huron dropped at the fastest rate ever observed, and there's a very long record there, beginning about that time, and it reached its lowest level ever recorded in about 2013. And our lakes were doing the same thing. And quite frankly, we don't know why that's happened. Something has changed in this signal that's been driven by precipitation and evaporation. And data from some of our other colleagues suggests that the evaporation signal may be coming much stronger.
Is that 13-year cycle a pattern of climate, and is it possible that climate change is disrupting that 13-year cycle?
Well, it's definitely climatic. There's an atmospheric phenomenon that starts in the central North Pacific near Japan, and it generates a wave train that moves across the Pacific up into North America, across our area, and then out into the North Atlantic. It's similar to the jet stream, but it's located in a different place in the atmosphere, and that's what determines the storm tracks around our region and across North America. And when that's set up the right way, our water levels rise, and they rise because the moisture from the Gulf of Mexico is swept into our region, and we see more precipitation and less evaporation. Now, when it's not set up that way, our lakes fall because we're getting more evaporation and less precipitation. Now, what we have are correlations between that and our lake levels, so it would suggest that something's changed in that atmospheric process.
And is that change what we would point to and say, this is global warming, this is climate change?
That's a big step.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know whether things have changed for the long run or whether this is just kind of a hiccup in what's happened in the past. And really, only time's going to be able to answer that question.
One thing that I've seen people blame is not that cycle of precipitation and evaporation, but human activity, widening channels leading out of the Great Lakes into the St. Lawrence Seaway, letting too much water out of the Great Lakes. You don't see that as a main factor?
Well, since our little lakes are behaving the same way as that huge lake, and our groundwaters are doing the same thing, it seems unlikely that that's the cause for the recent very low water levels. It may be a contributing factor, but the big factor is something else. It's something related to climate.
We're in the midst of a very cold winter, high ice levels, much higher than we've seen in a while. How does that affect the water levels in the lakes?
Well, they bounced back. They bounced back last summer, but they haven't bounced back to where they normally are. They're still well below their long-term averages and way below their long-term peaks. So it's helping, and we expect these sorts of things to occur over time. We'll see things rebounding and then dropping again and rebounding. And the question really is, are we ever going to get back to our old cycle? And as I mentioned, our crystal ball doesn't let us look that far ahead.
What are the implications if we don't bounce back to that level for the environment and maybe for the economy?
Well, lakes are certainly a big part of the economy up north, and we are in a very water-rich region. We depend heavily on our water. Less of it is probably not a good thing. There was an interesting study that came out just before ours by researchers at the Center for Limnology that demonstrated how these low water levels affect fish populations. If you look at photographs of these northern lakes, you see that the coarse woody habitat, the fallen trees that are in the near shore and serve as critical habitat for fish, were exposed. So that habitat was eliminated, and that study demonstrated that the fisheries can be greatly impacted by these water level fluctuations, in particular low water levels.
What's the nature of research? Often that one answer generates a dozen questions. What questions are you excited to research next? What research do you think needs to be done now?
Well, I think this study focused a lot of attention on evaporation. We're really good at measuring precipitation, and we've been doing it for a long, long time. But we're just beginning to develop the tools to measure evaporation. It's particularly difficult to measure evaporation from a huge lake like Lake Michigan, Huron, or Lake Superior. Our smaller lakes are a bit easier, so we're hoping to develop tools on these smaller lakes that will help us understand what's going on at the bigger lakes as well.
Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Carl Watrous. He's a research scientist with the Wisconsin DNR. It's time to talk Congress now.
Congress is actually off this week for its mid-January break, which has some people wondering, should representatives spend more time getting work done in Washington, or do the breaks allow them to stay grounded in local politics back home?
Also, with President Obama's State of the Union speech coming up next Tuesday, is he going to be able to set the agenda for Congress? Where do proposals on NSA reforms, immigration, and income inequality stand in Congress?
Here with us for our weekly update is Paul Singer. He's the politics and Congress editor at USA Today, and he tweets at Singer News. Paul, great to have you back.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Congress recently returned from a break, as I understand it, at the beginning of January. They're on break again now. And some observers and politicians think, you know, they're gone an awful lot when there's so much work to be done. So why is there? Can you make the case for all the downtime that's built into the schedule?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the obvious reason for the downtime built in the schedule is they say it's not downtime. It is time spent back in the district, working with their constituents on issues, getting to, you know, hear from constituents about things that matter to them. They would make the argument, well, you want us here on the ground in, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, because you want us to be able to hear from you more regularly and you want more access to us. Of course, there really is this tension in American politics, right? On the one hand, we don't want our politicians to become career politicians, people who are beholden to Washington, who spend all their time in Washington. We love to elect outsiders. On the other hand, when they don't go to Washington, we complain that they're goofing off. and so then we argue, well, why aren't you in Washington solving the nation's problems? It is a bit of a double-edged sword. I'm not sure there's a real way for them to win that issue. But they do have, you know, written into their schedules now, at least a week a month is recess. But they'll say it's district work period, not recess.
So that's the branding there, and maybe that's exactly what they're doing. There are, the Christian Science Monitor, they had a piece about people who want some reform and about how some of these people look back at what they call the good old days when the representatives, they lived in Washington, they went to all the kids' soccer games together, the same barbecues. And in short, I guess they kind of knew each other. It wasn't fly in, fly out anymore. And you can imagine that the schedule right now with all the recesses could be tough when you're trying to get to a place of bipartisanship.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, some of that is rose-colored glasses. You know, I mean, the members of Congress who are here, they still are pals. They still get together and, you know, share a beer and stuff. There's a really, particularly for newer members of Congress and particularly for the Republicans, it's a really interesting tension. Because a lot of them, again, they came as outsiders or as Tea Party supported candidates. They don't want to become wedded to Washington, so they choose not to even have a home here in D.C. They sleep in their congressional offices on Capitol Hill.
Really?
Yeah. There's several dozen of them that sleep on cots in their offices, and they leave their family back in the district. Well, I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing either, right? Because then you're away from your family. You're not doing anything at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday night except sleeping on a cot in your office. If someone calls you up and says, hey, let's go to the bar and get a beer, you're likely to go and irresponsible bad things happen. So it's a tension that the members, particularly incoming members now, have to grapple with. Is do you want to leave your roots really planted in wherever it was you came from? Or do you want to have your family with you and you know, set up some stake in Washington, D.C.?
So it sounds like there's arguments on both sides. Do you see the situation with recesses changing anytime soon, or is this just the way it is now?
Nah, it is the way it is. I mean, this is very much the way it is. I think it's institutionalized. In fact, in the House calendar, they've already put out the whole year's schedule of when we'll be off. So it's very much in the bloodstream here.
And is there evidence that when there are recesses, that Congress is in fact back home, getting in touch with the people in their district?
Well, sure. But there's also evidence that frequently when there are recesses, they are back home making touch with their good friends in Switzerland or Hawaii or some other fun place to go on a congressional delegation. I mean, right now, there's a congressional delegation gone to Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. You could, again, make the argument that it's important for members of Congress to go hobnob with the sort of intellectual elite on economic affairs, or you could make the argument that taxpayers have just spent several hundred thousand dollars sending 10 members of Congress over to a highfalutin Swiss resort to basically party.
You know, we have a call. We don't normally take calls during this segment, but let's take this one. We've got Jill joining us from Janesville. Hi, Jill. Jill,
hi,
are you with us?
I just wanted to, yeah, hi. I wanted to comment right away when I heard that there was a feeling that maybe these people weren't working when they're home. My personal experience has been serving on Congressman Ryan's healthcare advisory board, and he goes right from one board meeting after then to ours and then heads to another one. So I can say from my personal experience that I see our congressman work very hard when he's not in D.C. And I believe that he does keep his roots at home so that he can be connected and stay connected.
All right. Well, that's great. It's great to hear from you and to hear that story about Wisconsin. And Paul, that sounds like something that a lot of, I imagine, representatives in Congress would say they do the same. They're working hard.
Yeah.
They're going home and they're keeping in touch.
And it's very true that, you know, the members were basically ordered in the previous Congress, go back to your district and do these, what they call Congress in your corner, Congress on your corner, I think they called it. You know, go have public events in the district. Let them get to know you. Of course, a lot of those, they also do a lot of fundraising events. There's a book, I will tell you, I teach journalism as well, and there's a book I frequently assign that then Congressman Sherrod Brown from Ohio wrote a book about called Congress from the Inside. And he has in there some of his schedule. He's now a senator from Ohio. But he has in there some of his schedule of the weekends he goes home. You know, he's doing a parade on the 4th of July and then the Rotary breakfast and then he's meeting with constituents. And it's exhausting. Some members will tell you they get more rest and relaxation here on work weeks than they do back in the district.
Well, that's interesting, and it's not something that's going to be changed anytime soon, it sounds like.
So, I don't think so.
Let's move on to some actual prospective legislation. There was a report out this morning in the New York Times describing some bipartisanship on immigration between Democrat Esther Olivaria and Republican Rebecca Talent, and some people saying that these two are going to put their heads together and they could be the glue that held immigration reform together. What do you make of that?
Well, sure. I mean, neither one of them is actually a member of Congress. Ms. Talent now is a staffer working for Mr. Boehner, and Ms. Olivaria is working for the White House on these issues. You know, these are the people who will be sort of, you know, working the deal or working to get the deal at some point if they can get that far. But, you know, don't get your hopes up. The first thing that's going to happen is we're waiting for Mr. Boehner to release a basically a set of principles on what should be in an immigration bill coming out of the House. And so here it is, the last week of January, we'll get a set of principles. That's not legislation, that's principles.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Is that unusual, issuing a set of principles in the lead-up to a vote?
Well, I don't know about unusual. I mean, it's not all that unusual for, you know, the party leaders to do stuff like that. Say, here are the kind of things we want to get into legislation. I think what's unusual about it is that the Senate already has passed a bill. The House has four or five bills that have passed out of committee already. It seems odd to go back to the principles stage when you're this far down a legislative road. And it raises questions about, well, okay, if you're just issuing principles now, what's that mean for actually developing a bill? And again, in the House, they're less interested in developing a comprehensive bill. They're more interested in doing several pieces of legislation independently that they think are more palatable.
And next Tuesday, another thing on the horizon is President Obama's State of the Union address. How likely is it that he has enough political capital left to set the agenda for Congress?
Well, he definitely has the ability to set the conversation, right? I mean, there is nothing like a State of the Union address to focus the national conversation around key topics. And we think that Obama is going to want to focus the national conversation around, for want of a better word, income inequality issues like raising the minimum wage, like reinstating unemployment insurance for the long-term unemployed. Those are the kind of issues where he can really focus a bright light in that moment, right? Having the podium and having a big national audience. Now, I'm not sure that means he can actually wrangle a bill through Congress, but he can definitely set the tone for the national discussion. And I think that those are the things you're going to hear quickly then followed up by Democrats in Congress trying to move the unemployment bill that got stuck before they left, to try and possibly move something on minimum wage, possibly some other things to, you know, more flexible hours for working mothers kind of things. Things that address that topic, whether or not they pass or not, is a bigger issue. But I think the president certainly has the opportunity to drive the conversation here.
And he did bring a lot of attention to NSA reforms last Friday. Is that something that could be moving through Congress?
Yeah. Yeah, that will definitely be on the agenda next week. In fact, I believe it's Wednesday the Judiciary Committee will be hearing from Attorney General Eric Holder. I think he's coming up for a hearing on the Justice Department. And I have no doubt this will be a central theme of that conversation, is the NSA reforms, because they do have, you know, now they have some actual reforms recommended by the president, and they're going to have to start moving on trying to implement some of these things, or at least discuss whether they can implement them. Now, keep in mind, we may not hear details about a lot of this stuff because it may be classified. But I think some portions of it, you know, if they can figure out a way to, you know, get the government out of the business of collecting giant databases on all our telephone calls, we'll probably hear about that.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for joining us and keeping us up to date.
Always a pleasure, Veronica. Talk to you again.
We've been speaking with Paul Singer for our weekly Washington Update. He is the politics and Congress editor at USA Today and tweets at Singer News.